Let's start the press briefing of the UN Information Service here in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 28th of January. We have high on the news the situation in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Lots of colleagues who have come to brief you on this situation. I will start with Jens from OCHA here on my left. We have online Matt Salmash for UNHCR, Shelley Takaral, the WFP spokesperson in DRC from Kinshasa. She is connected online. Dr. Adelaide Marchang, the emergency response coordinator for the DRC at WHO. I think she's also connected online. And on my right, Patrick Youssef, the ICRC regional director for Africa. So we will listen to all these colleagues, and then we will open the floor to questions. And thank you, everybody, for participating and for briefing us on this extremely dire situation. So I'll start with Jens to have an idea of the humanitarian situation there. Jens.
Yeah, thank you, Alessandra, and good morning, everyone. The humanitarian situation in and around Goma remains extremely worrying. And again this morning, our colleagues in the Democratic Republic of the Congo report heavy small arms fire and mortar fire across the city and the presence of many dead bodies in the streets. We have reports of rapes committed by fighters, looting of property, including of a humanitarian warehouse, and humanitarian and health facilities being hit. Hospitals in Goma are reportedly overwhelmed, struggling to manage the influx of wounded people. Electricity and water supplies are compromised, and yesterday internet services were cut off, and Goma is still offline this morning. Since the flare-up of hostilities in the beginning of the year, hundreds of thousands of people have attempted to flee the violence, including the 700,000 people already displaced and living in dire conditions on the outskirts of Goma. On Friday, sites hosting at least 300,000 internally displaced people were completely emptied due to the rapid advancement of the front lines. Non-essential humanitarian staff have been relocated to reduce risks, but critical personnel remain in Goma. As you may have seen, the UN's emergency fund, the SURF, has immediately allocated $17 million to support the humanitarian response. The humanitarian coordinator in the DRC, Bruno Le Marquis, has called on all parties to agree on temporary humanitarian pauses in the most affected areas and establish humanitarian corridors to ensure humanitarian activities can resume at scale and facilitate the safe evacuation of wounded people and civilians trapped in combat zones. The humanitarian coordinator has also stressed that it is critical to ensure the safe reopening of the Goma airport and to keep the border posts between Rwanda and the DRC in Goma operational to enable people to flee the violence. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jens. I'd like to give the floor online to Matt Salmash for UNHCR.
Thanks, Alessandra, and good morning, everyone. The humanitarian crisis in the DRC has further deteriorated since our last briefing to you on Friday, with now nearly 500,000 people displaced in North and South Kivu provinces in January alone. Hundreds of thousands have been forced to flee multiple active conflict zones, and the capacity to accommodate and assist them is now saturated. Many of those displaced have fled violent attacks, including the use of heavy artillery targeting internally displaced people sites. These are spaces that are intended to provide safety and refuge. These attacks have destroyed shelters, essential infrastructure, and tragically claimed many lives. Several sites on the outskirts of Goma, as we heard from Jens and OCHA, housing more than 300,000 people, were completely emptied within hours over the weekend, and 18 IDP sites around the city have been largely emptied as those who are displaced flee heavy artillery. We remain in the country and in the area, and we're ready to assist when the conditions will allow. The restricted access to the conflict zones is worsening conditions for millions of the displaced people. With our partners, UNHCR calls on all parties involved in the conflict to immediately respect international humanitarian law and to prioritize civilian protection. Our protection monitors are also closely following cross-border movements. We understand that many people are waiting to assess the situation before making further decisions. With our partners, we're ready to respond to any outflow of asylum seekers from the country, ensuring their protection and providing critical assistance to those in need. The humanitarian crisis in the DRC is not just a regional concern, but it's a global responsibility. The displaced Congolese people deserve an opportunity to live with safety, dignity, and hope. The international community must step up efforts to support affected populations and to facilitate long-term solutions to end this cycle of violence. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mats. We have online Shelley Takral from Kinshasa. Good morning, madam. Can you brief our journalists on the situation of food in Eastern DRC?
Thank you, Madam Speaker and colleagues. And may I also reiterate the worsening situation and growing humanitarian and protection needs that we're facing. A major surge in violence in the eastern region of DRC has led to hundreds of thousands of people fleeing multiple active conflict zones. WFP's priority is keeping staff and their dependents safe. Only critical WFP staff remain in the area, and once the security situation improves, we can resume our emergency assistance and operations. There are growing protection concerns as hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced in and around Goma. Many are exposed to gender-based violence and with limited access to food, safe, clean water, and income, the risks facing the populations hour by hour, day by day, will only increase in these volatile conditions. We've seen families fleeing the fighting, and they're facing unimaginable challenges. Every step of their journey is fraught with danger. Roads are blocked, ports are closed, and those crossing Lake Kivu risk their lives in makeshift boats. Certain IDP sites have been emptied where fighting has been the most violent. I spoke just moments ago to an activist in Goma, and he told me, "We're here, we're hiding. We don't know who will come to help us." There's massive displacement of the population, including both new people and those who have been displaced multiple times. Even before this recent escalation in violence, some 5.1 million people in Ituri, North and South Kivu have been displaced and forced to live in overcrowded camps with little food and no security. Food assistance activities in and around Goma have been temporarily paused. WFP is concerned about food scarcity in Goma and rising food prices as the airport and major access roads within the region have been cut off. So depending on the duration of violence, the supply of food into the city could be severely hampered. This is a huge test for Congolese trapped by fighting in Goma and surrounding areas of their resilience. And the next 24 hours will be critical as people start to run low on supplies and will need to see what they can find to survive. WFP finally wants to reiterate that we strongly condemn the escalation of violence in the Eastern DRC that's endangering these populations. We call on all parties to the conflict to immediately cease hostilities and uphold obligations under international humanitarian law, including the protection and safety of humanitarian workers.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Takral. I'll give the floor to Dr. Adelheid Marchand, Madam, to hear about the health situation and consequences of the violence in this region. I don't have on my notes the place where you are talking from. If you could tell our journalist, and I give you the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, good afternoon. I'm talking from Geneva, and I will speak with you today on the health implications of the violence in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in the eastern DRC around the city of Goma. Goma, previously a refuge for hundreds of thousands of displaced people, is now at the center of escalating conflict, further endangering lives. WHO Assistant Director General for Health Emergencies, Dr. Chikwe Ihekweazu, recently visited Goma to assess the humanitarian and MPOX response. WHO has hubs in North and South Kivu in the cities of Goma and Bukavu, from where we respond and will continue responding to the Eastern DRC's health needs. Before the airport at Goma closed this Saturday, WHO was able to send critical medical supplies for trauma and emergency care, infection prevention, cholera, and basic essential health needs. WHO is providing tents for hospitals to expand their treatment capacities and to cope with the increasing number of injured. Hospitals are overwhelmed. There are currently hundreds of people in hospital, most admitted with gunshot and shrapnel wounds. Secondary infections become a health risk. WHO is especially worried for the health and safety of women and girls who are at the higher risk of violence, including rape. Pregnant women are at risk with very high maternal death rates, even before this recent escalation of violence. Capacities to deal with the newly injured are stretched, and WHO is working with authorities and partners to identify solutions and to increase local capacities to deal with this. Sadly, hospitals and health workers are in danger too. We are hearing reports of health workers being shot at and patients, including babies, being caught in crossfire. WHO reminds everyone that attacks on healthcare violate the rules of war. Healthcare must be protected at all times. With people again on the move and infrastructure such as water stations and electricity grids damaged, the conditions are rife for the spread of infectious diseases like cholera and measles. And along with the physical toll, there is also the mental health toll of this emergency. While these risks grow, it also becomes much harder for people to get the healthcare they need, and their coping mechanisms are exhausted. Displacement happens over large distances. People get exhausted and desperate. Last year, North and South Kivu reported 21,672 cases and 59 deaths from cholera and 11,710 cases and 115 deaths from measles. Malaria continues to be a major killer in the region. Eastern DRC is the epicenter of the outbreak of the new MPOX strain, which the WHO Director General declared of a public health emergency of international concern in August 2024, just a few months ago. Over 20,000 suspected cases of MPOX have been reported from North and South Kivu since 2024, including more than 6,000 in the last 6 weeks. Because of the violence, it's hard to properly track and treat the disease, even more so when people are constantly on the move. Over one in four people living in the region is facing emergency levels of food insecurity and risk of hunger, with many people malnourished and weak in the face of disease. WHO is looking at scaling up the response as much as possible in the current situation, while at the same time ensuring the safety of its staff. It is essential for WHO and other humanitarian partners on the ground to have safe and assured access to people in need. Thank you. Back over to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And last but definitely not least, on my right, Patrick Youssef, ICRC.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And sorry, we're quite all heartbroken because of we have to be back again here and talk about the blood and suffering in the east of DRC. In the past days, with a growing alarm, we have been following developments in Sudan and the eastern DRC. I'm sure many have seen the horrific images that emerged from Al Saudi Hospital in Sudan City Al-Fashir, where dozens of people were reportedly killed. During that same time in Goma, heavy shelling and shooting in densely populated areas have resulted in an influx of many hundreds of injured. More than 100 people within 24 hours arrived at Ndosho Hospital, where the ICRC surgical teams are working. We would normally receive this number of patients in 1 month. The influx is such that the hospital parking was transformed yesterday into a triage zone. Beds are lacking and patients are left without anything and waiting in corridors. And while the hospital is overwhelmed, we're still receiving calls from desperate injured people who struggle to access healthcare. Our teams, together with the hospital staff, have been treating people with mortar and shrapnel wounds, many of them with head wounds and chest traumas. Very disturbingly, we have seen a significant increase in the number of severely injured children. We've described what we see in two different conflicts in two different countries, but there is a very alarming common trend. Civilians are paying an increasingly heavy price for brutal armed conflicts, and this must stop. We urgently call on the parties to respect their obligations under the Geneva Conventions and do everything possible to spare civilians and civilian infrastructure. By the way, in both DRC and Sudan, we increasingly see the use of heavy artillery in populated areas, which compromise access to essential services like water, electricity, and healthcare. I remind you that the second worst displacement crisis in the world is in the DRC, and the first one is unfortunately in Sudan by all standards. To conclude, in DRC and Sudan, we continue our dialogue with the parties and insist they take immediate measures to protect civilians and critical civilian infrastructure. And unless the law is protected and respected, the human toll will continue to grow. Before entering the room, I just learned that our medical warehouse was looted in Goma and unfortunately has to be now urgently and refurbished. That will obviously take time, but there is just one that we have noticed ourselves compared to the thousands of heavy tolls taken by the civilians in Goma. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. And just to conclude, I just would like to remind you that we have distributed on Sunday the statement of the spokesperson for the Secretary General on the situation in DRC, and also yesterday the Security Council press statement on this situation. There is quite a lot of information there, too. So, and before I open the floor to questions, journalists are asking online, and I'm sure also in the room, that everybody sends their notes as soon as possible during the briefing, so that they can be sure that they report correctly. Okay, lots of questions. I've seen Yuri first. I will say to our colleagues who you are, as they don't all know you. Yuri Aprelev, RIA Novosti.
Bonjour, Monsieur Patrick Youssef. Je vais vous poser la question en français. Par rapport au staff du CICR que vous avez sur place, est-ce que vous comptez les laisser? Combien est-ce que vous en avez? And same question for OCHA, Jens. Do you know how many people you still have there? And because we heard about the fact that the UN is calling back the non-essential staff, but how many people are still remaining there and how many people were sent out from this area? Thank you.
Donc notre stratégie n'était pas d'évacuer qui que ce soit, bien au contraire, nous avons 19 staffs généralistes qui travaillent encore à Goma, ainsi qu'en plus 14 staffs médicaux qui travaillent 24 heures à l'hôpital de Ndosho, à l'hôpital de référence à Goma également, ainsi que dans d'autres centres de santé. Donc le motto c'est de rester, c'est de travailler et c'est justement d'engager, comme nous l'avons fait depuis plusieurs mois, les parties au conflit en préparation à ce qui allait venir et voilà ce qui s'est arrivé.
Yeah, thank you. As you know, often in these situations of armed conflict, we do not give specifics about our staff. I will ask if that is something we can tell you, because it is, of course, as we've heard from other colleagues now, a security issue also for those. What our point is that essential staff that are critical for program implementation are still in Goma. And they are the ones who will help, implement the programs that the 17 million from the SURF has now, that has been injected in the response, which is, as you know, very underfunded already. So those people are still there. The non-essentials have been relocated for their safety.
Maybe just to add to this what Jean-Pierre Lacroix, our Undersecretary General for Peace Operations, said yesterday, and I quote him, the mission has begun temporarily relocating its personnel and their dependents from Goma over the weekend by air and road. The process is ongoing with relocations continuing as he spoke. That was yesterday. Obviously, the safety and security of our personnel is and must be paramount, but parallel to that, of course, our colleagues at MONUSCO continue to deliver on their obligation to protect civilians to the best of their ability. And it's really important, I think, as Jens said, to say that whatever decisions are taken for the safety and security of our colleagues, the most important focus for us is the protection of really millions of civilians whose life and fate really are at risk at the moment. Small.
Just a quick follow-up, Jens. We have seen, especially in Sudan and in Gaza the past years and in the past conflicts, that the UN staff are not under great protection, as it has to be the case. Have you seen any incidents with your staff in DRC? Thanks.
Thank you. I have not seen any reported incidents against OCHA staff, but that means what I said. It means that I have not seen any reports from that. It doesn't mean that it hasn't happened, but I have no indication that that's the case.
Emma Farge, Reuters.
Good morning. I was hoping that WHO might be able to give us an estimate of the death toll, maybe from hospitals, and maybe Jens could give us an idea of how many dead bodies have been seen. I'm wondering if you have any idea of the scale of this at this stage. Thank you. Or Patrick, thank you.
Thank you. I'll start with Dr. Machang. Do you have any figure on the casualty, ma'am?
Thank you. We do not have any figures on the overall numbers of deaths. However, we, from contacts with all the hospitals that we have maintained as much as possible, and that was what we received as of Saturday morning, there were over 600 to 700 patients in beds in at least 4 to 5 hospitals that are taking in wounded patients. We will be able again to give an updated figure once communication is established, but that doesn't mean that on the ground they don't have that figure. So we are constantly in contact with hospitals looking at the gaps in equipment, in treatment capacity, and as highlighted, we have constantly and flexibly try to allocate tents to increase bed capacity and treatment capacity, not just for the injured that have been overwhelming hospitals, but of course also for other ailments that are coming in at the same time. Also looking at maintaining an overview over patients with infectious diseases and of course child illnesses. As we move forward, we are hoping to be able to allocate more supplies from what has already come in, as mentioned. We have made distribution plans, and as the streets and the security allows, we've heard that it was quite dire yesterday and even this morning. We are ready to dispatch more of these items. We are very concerned also about the issue of intra-facility, intra-hospital infectious prevention so as to prevent secondary causes of deaths from wound infections or from other or from intra-hospital infectious disease transmission, and therefore very mindful to prevent infections at the hospital level, and had teams that were in contact with health workers to understand if there were any outstanding needs that we are covering as we move forward. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. To Emma's question about if we know how many dead bodies are in the street, of course we don't. As I just mentioned this morning, we have reports of heavy small arms fire and mortar fire across the city. So for people's own safety, we don't walk around the streets and count. But I have no reason to doubt the reports that we get from our colleagues who are able to have a look out their windows, what they see in the street.
Just for housekeeping, I've got Jeremy, AFP, FE, Gunilla, DPA, Beza. Just lots of questions. Let's go ahead with Jeremy. Je te présente Jeremy Lange, Radio France Internationale.
Thank you, Alessandra. I think you all mentioned IDPs being attacked, patients if being shot at. I think that's what WHO said. And Patrick, you mentioned also like the shrapnel wounds and the mortar injuries. I'd like to understand all those IDPs, civilians being caught in the crossfire, like in the middle of the shootings, or are they being deliberately targeted from what you're seeing on the ground?
Who would like to start? Colleagues, when there are questions also where you feel you can contribute, just let me know. I'm with those who I can see, but also online from Kinshasa.
Patrick, vous pouvez répondre en français aussi.
Parfait. Patrick. Donc en fait, il y a forcément deux tendances. Un, on est devant une nouvelle situation, donc une poussée sur les Minova et sur les régions avoisinantes. Et donc là, effectivement, il y avait beaucoup de crossfire. C'est ce qu'on apprend aussi à Goma. Les populations sont en fuite. Et effectivement, c'est ce que nous avons appris encore. Mais à mon avis, il est très prématuré d'avoir une réponse claire de pourquoi et comment. Donc je pense que le shelling a été fait dans les quartiers résidentiels et c'est ce que nos équipes nous rapportent. C'est que comme d'ailleurs nos staffs résidents qui continuent à être à la maison, il se peut effectivement qu'il y ait un incident de sécurité de ce type avec des shellings, des bombardements qui résultent effectivement avec des morts ou des blessés. Et c'est ce qu'on reçoit de plus en plus à l'hôpital. Après, la source de l'attaque, il faut encore du temps pour effectivement avoir les bonnes analyses. Je vous rappelle juste que nos trois équipes chirurgicales travaillent depuis 48 heures non-stop à l'hôpital et il est très difficile d'avoir toujours les rapports détaillés de leur travail.
I see we have Ravina online. She has raised her hand. Ravina, would you like to add something? Ravina Shamadasania, OHCHR.
Thank you, Alessandra. I just wanted to back up what colleagues are saying. We remain in the country as well. As you know, there's a joint human rights office that's a part of MONUSCO. And we have staff across the country, including some staff in Goma at the moment. Colleagues pointed out the security situation for the UN. I also wanted to add that we are actually profoundly concerned for the situation of human rights defenders, civil society actors, and journalists in Goma. And we are reminding all parties to the conflict of their obligation to ensure the protection of civilians, including these people who are particularly at risk. Similar to what colleagues have conveyed, we're also hearing reports of heavy gunfire, urban combat, and the use of explosive weapons within populated areas. And once again, we remind all parties to the conflict of their obligations under international human rights law and international human rights and humanitarian law to ensure the protection of civilians.
Thank you very much for this addition, Ravina. As I said, colleague, please feel free to intervene. I've got Nina Larson, AFP. In the list.
Yes.
Pardon?
Yes.
Ça va pas du tout. Agnès Peder, AFP. Mais c'est le même média, pas la même personne. Pardon, Agnès.
Pas de souci. Thanks all for your briefings. A follow-up to WFP and a question to ICRC on the suspension of... I don't know if WFP is still listening.
WFP, okay. Shelley is online. Okay. Yeah.
Yes, on the suspension of food assistance in DRC, in Goma, specifically, if you could specify if it's only UN food assistance or all food assistance of any organizations. Et pour le CICR, concernant le pillage de votre entrepôt, est-ce que vous avez des détails sur les quantités de fournitures qui se trouvaient à l'intérieur? And other organizations, UN organizations, have you seen also any lootings of your warehouses? Thank you.
Yeah, I'll start with Shelley.
Thank you so much. We have also a critical team on the ground who are just really there to ensure that, you know, as soon as we can, as soon as safety permits, and these are just in areas which have been affected by the ongoing violence. We are still operating in other parts of North Kivu, South Kivu, where we can kind of get to people as safely as possible. In terms of looting, sadly, the situation has deteriorated. And to reiterate also on the human rights and also with ICRC, we are seeing some of our warehouses being looted. This is also just one warehouse in particular close to the airport. I mean, this is just goes to tell you how desperate, you know, how desperate people are now in terms of, you know, what it is they need and what we're really asking for in terms of a cessation of these, you know, violent atrocities that are happening. There are stray bullets, they are loose ammunition which are getting into the hands of the wrong people, which if we don't contain quickly and as soon as possible, you know, this will just, you know, grow into a much larger crisis than it already is.
Patrick.
Thank you.
Oui, merci. Donc, pour la question, en fait, nous venons de l'apprendre, mais nous savons aussi que c'était des générateurs, des airs conditionnés et aussi la réserve du stock médical. Ceci dit, ça fait depuis quelques jours que les équipes travaillent et utilisent justement ce contingent médical que nous avons à Goma. Et donc, je ne peux pas dire que ce n'est pas trop grave, mais c'est une réserve qui a déjà été bien utilisée et que le ravitaillement arrive depuis le Kenya, à voir si c'est à Bukavu, depuis Bukavu, puis directement à Goma. On va voir dans les quelques jours. Je vous rappelle aussi qu'il est très important de parler de deux choses. La première est dans le cadre, effectivement, de la protection de la mission médicale. Le CICR a fait donc des démarches et est encore très préoccupé par la situation au sein du laboratoire de l'Institut national de recherche biomédicale qui fait face à un risque de coupure d'électricité. Ainsi que une question de préserver justement les échantillons qui peuvent être touchés par les affrontements et qui pourraient engendrer donc des conséquences inimaginables si les souches bactériologiques dont le virus Ebola qu'il abrite venaient à se répandre. Et du coup, c'est très important de ne pas juste se focaliser sur... Bien sûr, il y a beaucoup de détresse et beaucoup d'appels de détresse, mais il y a aussi des facettes de notre action qui, oui, resteront toujours confidentielles et bilatérales, mais qu'on partage aujourd'hui au vu de l'urgence. Et donc, important de rappeler que le dialogue avec les parties, on est en contact permanent et régulier avec les parties au conflit pour effectivement maintenir ce dialogue prot et toucher à des sujets qui d'actualité et pas juste un rappel générique de ce que le droit nous leur accorde. Merci.
That's scary. Do you want to add anything on looting? Okay, so I'll go to the next question. Isabel Sacco, FA? No, it's good. So my next one is Gunilla von Hall, Svenska Dagenblatt.
Thanks for taking my question. I have two questions. Now, one is you mentioned gender-based violence, I think several of you, and rape. What information do you have? Is that who is behind that? Is it M23 or is it DRC soldiers? Second question is the Belgian foreign minister is accusing Rwanda of creating a catastrophic humanitarian situation. What is your comment to that? And are you concerned that donor countries would freeze aid to Rwanda that allegedly is behind the M23 offensive? Thanks.
Who wants to start on gender-based violence? I'm looking at my colleagues online also. Ravina and Shelley. Ravina.
If Shelley would like to go first, that's fine.
Okay, Shelley.
Thank you, Ravina. I just want to reiterate that gender-based violence in the camps surrounding Goma has been an issue for a long time. And when people have been multiply displaced from their homes and food, they've lost their incomes, food, and they have to go in search of firewood for cooking. They look to survival techniques. They look to survival sex. They look to see how do I feed my children? You know, how do I get food in front of my kids? So to sit here today and say who is responsible, you know, that's not for me to comment on, but I do want to reiterate that this is a protection crisis of huge proportions. And the longer people can't get food, they can't get clean water, they can't get to hospitals, they can't get what they need to survive, that is going to be a problem. Thank you.
Thank you. I see WHO, Dr. Marshang.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. And I concur with the comments from the health side. We have seen largely increases in cases of SGBV at health facilities in the camps around Goma, and we have scaled up the clinical and medical capacity to treat them, in addition to take care of the incredible trauma and stress that people, that women especially, go through this, as women have been more affected by this type of violence, at least in these conditions around Goma. Some women have been raped several times in their search for firewood or just going outside of the perimeters of the camps. We also receive new reports that there is an increase in rape along the pathways that some of the conflict partners are now taking into South Kivu. And we're very vigilant to be ready and have some solutions to follow the populations as they move, as we have to adapt to the moving nature, if you will, of the displaced, and to see to attend to their health needs where they are, including through mobile teams and mobile clinics. Back over to you.
Ravina?
Thank you, colleagues. Just to add to exactly what colleagues have said, even before this current escalation, there has been grave sexual violence taking place in the DRC. When the High Commissioner was in the DRC in April last year, and he visited camps for internally displaced people, including in Bulengo, he was told by women that they had to sell themselves in order to survive, and that they were subjected to sexual violence while they went out to get firewood to be able to take care of their families. We are already receiving reports as well of sexual violence during this current escalation. And it is important that there is a heightened risk of sexual violence against women in the DRC at the moment. And this needs to be taken very seriously. We are again calling on all parties to ensure that they ensure the protection of civilians and in particular vulnerable communities, in particular women.
Thank you to all. And just on the second part of your question, Gunilla, I think we can't speculate on what's going to happen on funds to this country, that country. But on the issue of the Rwandan support, I would like to refer you to both the statement of the spokesperson of the Secretary General and especially the one on the Security Council, which are very clear on the need, on the call on the Rwanda Defense Forces to cease support to M23 and withdraw from the DRC territory.
Just a very quick follow-up question. When you then say that the reports of rape, do you then mean that from both sides? I just need to understand what you mean. You're saying you're getting reports about rape and you don't want to say who it is, but is it from both sides or what do you mean?
Ravina.
It's so difficult to corroborate. As you know, reports of sexual violence are always difficult to document and corroborate. And in this climate, it's premature for us to be able to attribute responsibility. We are continuing to monitor and we will update you as the information is corroborated.
Thank you. Christian Ulrich, German News Agency.
Thank you. Patrick touched on this already, but I wonder about the UN, the appeals to all the parties to restrain and respect international humanitarian law is one thing, but who is the UN actually talking to and what is the response of those interlocutors? Thank you.
There are, I think, again, lots of information in what was said in these days. Basically, I think the one thing that USG Lacroix said yesterday very clearly was that we remain really strongly committed to supporting ongoing regional peace initiative and continue to engage with all relevant stakeholders to bring the parties back to the negotiation tables, which we are already doing. In this regard, he also said, we welcome the Eastern African Community announcement to hold the summit on the 28th of January, and we also look forward to the African Union Peace and Security Council session, which is scheduled for today. So we're really bringing together and using all our contacts and leveraging on all the counterparts' efforts to bring the warring party to the negotiating table again. And the SG, the Secretary General, reiterated the United Nations support to the Luanda process. That's what we have to come back to. Beyza had a question.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to ask about a little detail to the WHO about the cholera cases. You know, there is a risk. Are there a risk of a spillover to the neighboring countries? Also, are there any efforts on vaccination? Thank you. And I also have a second question, but on a different topic to Jens, but I can wait on that.
Yes, please. Let's finish. There's quite a few questions online on DRC yet. Okay, so Dr. Can you take... Beyza is our correspondent of the Turkish news agency, Anadolu Ansi. Sorry, I should have reintroduced you. Go ahead, doctor.
Okay, thank you. And great question. Thank you for the question. Of course, absolutely, there is a heightened risk for spillover of cholera into neighboring countries, neighboring provinces within DRC. We have seen this before. In terms of vaccination, we have had one of the largest vaccination campaigns, OCV, oral cholera vaccine vaccination campaigns, in December 2023, where a very high number of people were vaccinated in the East, that has shown some effect already on the immunity in 2024. We have now, again, just before the airports closed, I have to say, luckily brought in 1 million of vaccines, and another vaccination campaign was intended to take place. We have to reassess the situation and the people that were eligible for the vaccination, and to see under the current situations when some calm is being restored to apply those again. There is a very high risk when the Goma water system and electricity system and around Goma are damaged through combat fights, etc., that the access to safe water is hampered, is in danger, and electricity amplifies that. So there is a risk that increases highly when people would be willing or using lake water, but we have to, of course, pool our efforts and prevent that these situations occur. But the risk is highly increased, and we are taking measures to do everything possible, including vaccination, to mitigate this risk. Over.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Lots of people who have not had the chance to ask a question. Ok, vas-y.
Juste revenir rapidement sur ce que vous avez dit sur le, en parlant des maladies Ebola, où vous, pour être sûr de bien comprendre, le virus aujourd'hui, il est présent dans quoi ? Un laboratoire, plusieurs laboratoires, à Goma, dans la région ? Est-ce que ces sites ont été attaqués ? Enfin, voilà, juste vous faire répéter pour être sûr de bien comprendre.
Non, je faisais juste référence à Goma. C'est un centre très proche de notre délégation. Et du coup, l'intérêt est venu effectivement d'un point de vue, un angle purement protection. Donc on a fait justement les différentes interventions. Comme nous l'avons fait, et je pense c'est en lien avec la question précédente, sur un grand projet d'eau que nous avons depuis quelques années maintenant avec un grand nombre de partenaires pour assurer que la partie ouest de toute la ville de Goma ait accès à l'eau. Je n'ai pas d'informations dans d'autres laboratoires, mais je pourrais effectivement demander et vous revenir là-dessus.
Merci beaucoup. Let me go online now. Catherine, you've been patiently waiting with your hand up. Catherine Fiancombo-Kunga, our correspondent of France 24.
Yes, good morning, Alessandra. Good morning to all of you, and thank you for briefing us on DRC. I have a couple of questions. The first one, Alessandra, is for you. If I'm not wrong, there is a new meeting of the Security Council this afternoon, New York time, 9 p.m. Geneva time. An emergency meeting as the one which took place Sunday. So could you kindly send us the links and also statements that will be issued after the meeting as soon as possible, the 9 p.m. tonight. I'd like also to kindly request the spokespersons that haven't sent their notes, meaning WFP, to send it, because like that it will facilitate our coverage. I'd like to ask a question to WFP again, to Shelley. Could you please tell us about your supplies? For how many days do you have supplies left for WFP? And regarding ICRC, Monsieur Patrick Youssef, you spoke about shellings, des bombardements, and Jens spoke about the fact, or Mats, I'm sorry, spoke about the fact that IDP sites were empty due to fights. So did I understand well that this is due to the bombing, I mean, the shelling, les bombardements of Rwandese troops? It's Rwandese troops from Rwanda, soldiers from Rwanda that are, in fact, shelling and fighting in the streets with soldiers of DRC. Is that correct? Thank you.
Okay, Catherine, for me, yes, I can answer. I confirm indeed that it has been scheduled a meeting at 3 p.m. New York time on the situation in DRC. So yes, I'm happy to send to everyone the link to the webcast, and if we have any readout or any transcript, to also send it to you. WFP, Shelley, you want to take the other question, please? And for the notes, Ishita is online, so maybe Ishita can kindly circulate your notes. Go ahead, Shelley.
Thanks, Emma. Yeah, thank you so much for the question. Just literally up before. The situation deteriorated. So we're talking Wednesday, Thursday. We were feeding 800,000 people in these critical areas. We have the supplies, as long as the, you know, there is, like we've heard, looting going on. There is this lawlessness, this law and order problem. So, you know, we will replenish what we can. We want to get back to business as soon as possible. You know, we don't want to waste another minute here. But yeah, up until Friday, when it looked like, you know, things were circling Goma in such a way that we had to put the safety of our staff first, we will resume ASAP, and we will get to those camps, and we will get to the people. We will continue to do food assistance, cash assistance, to make sure that, you know, we... And also, this is now an urban issue with growing caseloads in Goma. So, you know, we really need to think about getting the food in, keeping people safe, and making sure that we can kind of continue the operations on the ground to really contain the situation. Thank you.
And Jens, maybe on the last part of the question, or anybody else who wants to intervene.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, what I can say and what I mentioned was that we had reports on Friday that these 300,000 people had moved out, and that was in the span of a few hours from camps outside Goma. As you know, what very often happens is that they move before the fighting hits. You know, there are rumors, they're aware that the fighting, the front lines are moving close, and they, you know, pick up sticks and they get out of there. So that seems to have been what happened in this instance.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Quick answer. Well, what we have, and again, analyzing the geographical scope of the war, is that the shelling is happening between the M23 and the defense forces of Congo. Now, we learned yesterday, and we read, like all of you, a statement from the spokesperson of the Rwandese defense forces talking about a civilian death toll. So again, I think it's quite premature, and for our teams to be able to get out of a bunker or out of a hospital or out of a shelter, just to be able to go to the field, repatriate a few cases, and then be able to do the actual protection work. And therefore, I think, before it's too late, we all know that the death toll, the injuries, but also the sexual violence will be rampant, and we will witness an upsurge. It's not like it's unpredictable. Comparing the trends from previous armed conflicts should lead us to learn what will happen in the next couple of days. Hence, diplomatic but also political actions are needed to support those women, men, are from the humanitarian community trying to do a good job, but will fail if no political conjunction allows us to have a better access and a safe access to those in need in Goma and outside.
Thank you very much. This time is Nina, Nina Larsson, AFP. I got the right one, Nina, sorry.
Yeah, it's me this time. I just had a quick follow-up, actually, for WFP. I was wondering if you could clarify. I understand that your aid isn't, food aid isn't going to Goma now, but is there other food aid available there? Are there other organizations who are able to provide food aid, or has all food aid been cut off?
Shelley?
Sorry, had to unmute. No, thanks for the question, Nina. I can only speak for the World Food Programme, and obviously we work with other partners. I know World Vision have probably also have evacuated and got their staff to safety. There are other smaller organisations, whether it's through community groups or churches on the ground, who I'm sure will be doing what they can to help provide some support. What I'd like to do, Nina, is come back to you with a little bit more information so I can follow up properly with the question that you've asked. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Laurent Sierra, Swiss News Agency.
Yeah, thank you for the briefing. A question on the airport. Jens, you mentioned the fightings this morning. Have you had any indication that the fightings around the airport are going on? And a question for the resupply on the short to middle term, if you will have to plan a massive airlift operation, what would be the consequences of the conditions of the airport? Because I can remember that because of the volcano, just half of the tarmac was available for landings, and will it have major consequences on a massive resupply operation if it has to take place? And for you, Alessandra, I don't know whether there is still an emergency summit planned in the next days between the Congolese president and the Rwandan president. Has the SG been approached to participate to that? Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Laurent. I unfortunately do not have verified up-to-the-minute information about the current situation and the fighting around the airport. But I do have a message which was conveyed by the humanitarian coordinator, and that is for those doing the fighting to ensure that the conditions are in place so that we can reopen that airport, right, for people to leave and for aid to come in. Very important. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I don't have an answer for you on your second question. I'll try to get something as soon as New York wakes up. Okay, so this, Kazmir, was that a hand up for something else? Okay, so I know that Beza had questions for Jens. We also have a couple more speakers, but if there are no other questions on DRC, I'd like to thank everybody really very much for this very comprehensive briefing. Not only, of course, Jens and Patrick, but also in the field, Shelley, Mats for UNHCR, and Dr. Machang in for WHO. Thank you very much to you all. And yeah, let's continue briefing the journalists on this dire situation. And I'll keep Jens on the podium before we go to the next speaker, Beza.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, gents. I want to ask about the UNRWA ban situation. You know, the Mr. Lazzarini told yesterday, whatever happens, we will stay in Gaza until we can operate, until as much as we can operate. I want to ask, are there any contingency plans regarding this, ensuring humanitarian access, but also the safety of the convoys and everything under the no-contact policy? And second question, are there any discussions with Israeli authorities about an exception to this decision, at least during the ceasefire window? Thank you.
Thanks. On UNRWA, we, as we have done since the beginning, we stand fully behind UNRWA and what they say and what Mr. Lazzarini is messaging about what they are doing. We all know, and we have repeated this many times over, they are the backbone of the humanitarian operation for logistics and many other purposes, particularly health and education. They are irreplaceable. They have thousands of staff still working there. They have hundreds of staff who have lost their lives continuing to work during these 15 months of conflict. So our position remains the same. They are an indispensable part of the operation, and they need to remain.
Absolutely. There was another question. Kazmira, sorry, I don't know for whom is that. Oh, sorry.
Sorry. A quick follow-up on what you think about the no contact policy will cause to the humanitarian safety and the operations in Gaza.
As I think we have said since this was first discussed in the political, you know, realm of this conflict, that does not make any sense. And I recall when they were first introduced, we urged as a UN system to reconsider these provisions. It does not make sense. It does not make sense to us.
Absolutely. Kazmira, I don't know for whom is the question.
Yes, Kazmira from Geneva Solutions. A question for Jens and other agencies and organizations in the room or online. It's about the freeze in US foreign assistance. Could you speak about the impact this has already had on the ground, on projects on the ground, please? Thank you.
Well, draw your attention to what was said yesterday by the spokesperson of the Secretary General. We have distributed to you the statement. So if you haven't received it, I will not repeat it online because we've already distributed and the spokesperson has already done it. But if you haven't received it, let me know. I can send it to you again. Don't know if there is any. I'm not sure we can add that much to what was said by the SG yesterday.
Ocha, we're part of the UN Secretariat, and the Secretary General is the boss of the Secretariat. So that is our statement as well.
I'll send it to you again, Kasmir, if you're not received.
Alessandra, are you able to comment specifically on Geneva, or projects in Geneva that have been effective? I've already heard from other conventions here of projects that were meant to be US funded that have had to be reshuffled or looking
for other look, I think this question has already been asked to me at the last briefing, but I think that we can we stick, of course, to what the Secretary General said, but for Geneva in particular, as you know, we have a lot of humanitarian agencies here. I think the situation is that the colleagues are now mapping out what the consequences of, first of all, it's a temporary decision, so we have to see how much this will impact the humanitarian activities of the Geneva-based agencies, number one. And number two, this is, of course, an assessment that needs to be done by all agencies, whether it will, you know, only last for a certain number of days, if it will continue. And these colleagues are doing now, and I don't think we can really state anything before we are aware of the details of this, of the implications, exact implications of this decision. I don't know if any colleague from any other humanitarian agency wants to say something. I see, Ravina, you've put your camera on. I don't know if you want to say something. Just let me finish by saying that the two main points that we really would like to stress is, first of all, that we are concerned. That is definitely a concern, as the Secretary General said yesterday, but we are also confident that we will be able to, if there are issues, to work with the US authorities to solve those issues and to make to overcome these problems. But it's obviously essential that the US authorities, which have been really, you know, the US have been behind so much humanitarian assistance, that it continues in the best possible ways. So I'll turn to Ravina, who would like to add something.
Thank you, Alessandra. Of course, we are also part of the Secretariat, so the Secretary General's statement, of course, applies to all of us, and the concern that he expressed. You asked about the specific impact on Geneva-based organizations. Just to say, we're grateful for the support that we've received from the United States over the years. They are one of our largest donors. We are still assessing the impact of this. But also to use the opportunity to call on all states to increase their investment in human rights. The cost of war is huge. The cost of instability is huge. And investment in human rights is really an investment in prevention of conflict and prevention of instability. And we urge all states and others to step up their contributions to this.
Indeed. I had seen another hand. Okay, Mohammed.
Thank you so much, Alessandra. My question is for Matt, for UNHCR, if he's still here.
I think he's there. Let me check. Let me just check. Give me 1 second. No, I don't see. Oh, yeah, he's there. He's there. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you so much, Matt.
Somebody has left his mic open. Can you please close it? We hear a echo.
Yeah. Yeah, Matt. As you know, Gaza is completely destroyed, almost completely destroyed after the by Israeli attack since 7 October. U.S. President Trump suggested that Palestinians in Gaza can be moved to neighbor countries like Jordan and Egypt, and then new housing can be built for them. He also said his opinions to another country's leader. My question is, how the first question is, do you think this kind of a plan is feasible, and how does the United Nations see this proposal? Thank you.
Maybe Matt, before I give you the floor, I just would like to remind you that yesterday the question was asked to the spokesperson of the Secretary General, who clearly stated what is the UN approach that we would be against any. First of all, it's hypothetical, so we don't comment until we know. It's just something which has been stated, but obviously, and we also see the comments from the countries involved. So of course, the United Nations would be against any plan that could or lead to the forced displacement of people, or could or would lead to any type of cleansing. Matt, maybe you want to say something about that. We can't hear you.
Thanks, Alessandra, okay, and thanks for the question. Yeah, I mean, no, we don't have really anything to add to what Alessandra said or what you heard from New York. You've seen the comments that have come from the countries that would be impacted by this. And of course, the United Nations has said that the UN would be against any plan that could lead to the forced displacement of people or that could lead to any other types of human rights issues. So we don't have anything to add to that at this stage.
Okay, so I would like to thank colleagues, and particularly Jens, who's still on the podium, I think. And we continue with the briefing. We've got Thomas from UNECE. I'd like to announce something. Positive.
Well,
we do need it different, positive. Yeah. And then we will go to WHO as the last speaker. Go ahead, Thomas.
Thank you, Alessandra, and good morning, everybody. Ukraine has ratified the amendment on public participation in decisions on the deliberate release into the environment and placing on the market of genetically modified organisms, known as the GMO amendment to the Aarhus Convention. Now, this amendment to the Aarhus Convention, and I will give the full name of that convention too, that is the UNECE Convention on Access to Information, Public Participation in Decision-Making, and Access to Justice in Environmental Matters. This amendment and the ratification by Ukraine triggers the entry into force of the amendment following its adoption by convention parties 20 years ago. So a significant step which will become effective on the 20th of April 2025. This means in practice that for the 33 parties that have ratified the GMO amendment, which include the European Union, as well as all UN member states joining the amendment or the convention in the future, it means they must establish in their regulatory framework effective means to ensure transparency and public participation in related decisions. I've circulated to you all the list of parties to the amendment and the list of parties to the convention. I'd like to read a short statement from the Executive Secretary of UNECE, Ms. Tatiana Molchan. I quote, "Ukraine's ratification of the GMO amendment to the Aarhus Convention, which brings it into force, is a milestone for the public's role in decision-making on this crucial topic for health and the environment, and has a far-reaching effect on present and future parties. This decision demonstrates the country's commitment to transparency and inclusive and effective decision-making in this challenging area. I encourage all Aarhus Convention parties to ratify the amendment and hope this step for multilateralism will further inspire our joint action for sustainable development." End quote. While the Aarhus Convention already establishes as law for its 47 parties the public's rights to information, participation, and justice regarding environmental matters, the GMO amendment introduces further clarification and specific provisions on this complex topic. The cultivation of genetically modified seeds is on the rise worldwide, and there has been a diversification in terms of the types of genetically modified organisms grown. To put that into perspective, the planting area worldwide of GM crops is estimated to have grown over 120 times since 1996, and now accounts for 13% of the total farmland area worldwide, exceeding 3.4 billion hectares. Now, the release of GMOs entails potential risks to human health and the environment, including to biodiversity. The increased use of GMO crops over the past decades has coincided with the increased use of pesticides, as well as herbicides and other chemicals in agriculture and indeed a growth in weed resistance to these. Global pesticide use has increased 13% since 2002 and has doubled since 1990. That's according to the Food and Agricultural Organization. Now, this means it is essential to ensure that the public has full access to all relevant information and is aware of and can effectively participate in decision-making on this topic. Now, the Aarhus Convention, and I recall this is a global treaty open to accession by all UN member states, which is now strengthened by this GMO amendment, offers all countries and stakeholders a solid framework for engaging the public in such decision-making. This is a useful tool for sustainable development, but also specifically to help advance implementation of the Cartagena Protocol on biosafety, and that's under the Convention on Biological Diversity. I would just add that the work on GMOs under the Aarhus Convention has been led by Austria, who is a lead party in this area. And as always, our experts remain available to answer your questions, and we are available to follow up on any specific matters. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas. No hands in the room. Let me see on the platform. No hands either, so thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much for this. I'll go to our last speaker now. Thanks, Thomas. We have online, I believe, Dr. Albis Gabrielli, who's the unit head of the Strategic Information and Analytics Global NTD program from WHO. But I see Christian has also put his camera. So Christian, maybe you want to start? And then we'll hear from the doctor.
I don't want to make it longer, so thank you all very much. Yes, let me present Dr. Albis Gabrielli, as you did already, a unit head for the Global Neglected Tropical Disease Program. And over to you, and I'm also available in case. Cheers.
Thank you. Thank you, Christian, Madam Chair. So this Thursday, the 30th of January, WHO and the global NTD community will be observing World Neglected Tropical Diseases Day under the theme Unite, Act, Eliminate. So this is one of the official global health days recognized by WHO. In fact, this is the first in the year in terms of calendar. And it offers an occasion to reflect on successes and challenges, which is the purpose of this briefing. So we also have a dedicated website to World Neglected Tropical Diseases Day, which is accessible from WHO's homepage. So I invite everyone to visit it. And we have an exhibition of panels dedicated to NTDs, as we call neglected tropical diseases, in the main building of WHO. So please come over. So NTDs are a diverse group of 21 conditions caused by diverse variety of pathogens, bacteria, viruses, parasites, fungi, and toxins as well. They're very different, but they have two features in common. The first one is the geographical environment. So the burden is mainly located in tropical countries, and then the social environment that the NTDs mainly affect poor communities. NTDs have a global burden. We estimate about 1 billion people affected and at least 120,000 deaths per year. And the total number of people requiring interventions every year is approximately between 15 and 20% of the global population, about 1.5 billion people globally requiring preventive or curative interventions every year, of which about 60 million in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, actually. NTDs not only have a medical burden in terms of morbidity, mortality, or disability, but they also have a very important social and economic burden in terms of stigma, social exclusion, discrimination, and then risk of worsening poverty due to out-of-pocket expenditures. Now, in terms of progress, I want to remember that the program, the global NTD program, was established by WHO 20 years ago, so in 2005. So this year we'll be celebrating 20 years. Over these 20 years, a lot of progress has been made. First of all, the concept that NTDs can be eliminated, so the transmission of NTDs can be interrupted, and WHO has established processes, official processes, to acknowledge the achievement of these goals. 54 countries have eliminated at least one NTD as of today, of which seven in 2024 only. And actually, we will be announcing two more countries on the occasion of World Neglected Tropical Disease Day, the day after tomorrow. So please check WHO's website for more information on contact us. The successes have happened thanks to a variety of strategic approaches that have been implemented, and these require cross-sectoral approaches, so veterinary public health, WASH, better control, and of course, treatment of humans through mass drug administration or individual disease management. And every year, approximately 800, 900 million people are treated for at least one neglected tropical disease. I say at least one because it's very common to find that people living in endemic areas suffer from 2, 3, 4 neglected tropical diseases. So this large-scale treatment happens thanks to large-scale donations that are made by pharmaceutical partners to WHO or directly to member states. And as of today, 20 medicines for NTDs are donated by 12 manufacturers globally. So, for example, in 2024 alone, approximately 1.8 billion tablets and vials were donated for treatment. Of course, we have challenges. NTDs are neglected, so we are used to face challenges. I would say at least a few of them. Certainly, one of the most important is the insufficient financial resources to implement programs at country level due to lack of prioritization at global level and at country level as well, very often also in countries that are endemic for NTDs. This results in uneven progress across countries and diseases. We see countries that have eliminated 2, 3, 4 NTDs and others that have not started implementing programs. We have a problem with dwindling capacities and expertise, including the difficulties in generating and collecting good quality data to the point that for some NTDs, we don't have a precise idea of the burden or how much people are affected. We also are affected by limited research and development, resulting in availability of only old medicines or old diagnostics. And then, of course, we have overarching challenges, including climate change. It is mainly affecting vector-borne diseases. Some NTDs are vector-borne, and conflict. For example, limited access to areas, especially in countries that are now approaching, for example, elimination or eradication of NTDs. Now, the way forward. Under the overarching umbrella of the NTD Roadmap 2021-2030, it not only sets targets and milestones, but also provides direction on how these targets and milestones can be achieved. I'd like to mention a few specific actions that have been implemented and are currently being implemented. First of all, the development of an implementation plan for the second 5 years of the roadmap with costing, and which we expect will facilitate resource mobilization. The establishment of some flagship programs, for example, dracunculiasis eradication. Two of the three diseases that are currently targeted by WHO for eradication are NTDs, dracunculiasis, guinea worm, and yaws. The Global Arbovirus Initiative, the skin NTD program, these are other examples of flagship programs. We are also expanding the offer of capacity building tools through collaboration with the WHO Academy, investigating the impact of climate change and adapting interventions to this change, and then strengthening data systems and supply chain for medicines in order to collect good data and also be able to deliver effectively medicines and other health tools. And finally, identifying research and development gaps through the development of a blueprint, of an R&D blueprint in collaboration with the science division that is going to be released this year. Thank you, Madam Chair. Over to you.
Thank you very much for this briefing. Let me see if there is any question for you online. Yes. No, Christian has asked for the floor. Christian, go ahead.
Just to add on, thank you very much, Elvis. He mentioned it briefly. There will be two updates sent shortly. If you want to get in touch for receiving those embargoed ahead of time, please do so to media inquiries. Thank you.
And yes.
Now I don't hear anything.
Yes, I have a question to WHO, but not on this last subject. So
I think Christian can take it, but I'd like to thank very much Dr. Albis Gabrielli for this briefing. Go ahead for your question to Christian.
Yes. Hi, Christian. I have two questions for you today concerning the situation in the US. First, we would like to have WHO reaction after a report saying that CDC was asked to stop to work with WHO. So how that will affect the health information system all over the world, in particular with the situation of the bird flu that is actually ongoing in the US and in other countries. And also, there are also reports about US investigating some bird flu strain on a duck farm in California, if you have any information about that. Thank you.
Christian?
Yep, thank you very much. I'm just looking for the H5 information, but what I can say on the other part is the US has always been a really important partner. So any cuts in any way would have an impact on the global health and on the people, and especially the poorest, those who need it most, no matter on what health sector and what health partner. But in regards of yesterday's recent announcement, I don't have any updates. The assessment of this and the evaluation of it is ongoing, actually, as we speak. And as there are daily new updates coming out, it's not easy to comment on a daily basis. So we'll have to see how all these announcements, similar to what the colleagues have just before on the other announcements, we'll have to see what the assessment of all the coming announcements and assess the situations is. On H5, give me a moment. Maybe let's go to the next question. I'm looking for this, otherwise we're wasting too much time here, but I'll get back to you on this one.
Okay, thank you. Gair Moulton, Associated Press.
Yeah, hi. Just a very quick follow-up on the CDC question. Can you say at this stage whether communication between CDC and WHO is already halted, or anything about what this means for the CDC staffers who are seconded to WHO?
Christian?
So yeah, thank you on that one. So I have no further information on what this actually means and how communication or whether it's stopped. I would really refer you to the US authorities, but at this point, I have no further update on how this plays out on the ground and in the many country offices and in the many programs where the US sometimes takes a leading role.
Emma has a question, but before doing that, I'd like to leave you in the hands of Rolando. And we still have one question, and then I don't know if there is any other subject, but I'll leave you with Rolando and give the floor to Emma.
Hi, good morning, Christian. It's on another topic. It's a long-running one, but I'd appreciate an updated comment from WHO. It's on the Gaza death toll. I'm wondering whether the ceasefire offers an opportunity to maybe get a clearer idea of the total death toll. And can you just say whether you still have confidence in the Ministry of Health figures, or maybe even more confidence since they've changed their methodology and have better access to the real scale of the deaths. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for this, Emma. So in terms of the death toll, yes, we do have confidence. But let's not forget, the death toll, the official death toll given by the Ministry of Health is deaths counted in morgues and in hospitals, so in official facilities. And it was always mentioned that we believe there are at least 10,000, if not more, people still under the rubble. And we've had that number since many, many months, unfortunately. So yes, now exactly, as people go back to their houses, as they will start looking for their loved ones under the rubble, this casualty figure is expected to increase. But let's not forget, in all this search and look, there are still unexploded ordnances around there. There are still mines or mainly ordnances, so unexploded shrapnel or unexploded weapons out there. So a search is and digging and is a certainly dangerous action to take, but likely the casualty rates are increasing and the mortality, the figures of deaths, the official figures of deaths will most likely increase.
Thank you very much, Christian.
I could go.
Oh, yep, go ahead. Please go ahead, Christian.
Oh, hello there. let me go back on that one question about the recently found H5N9 in the USA. I got that now. So the H5N9 virus detected at the California duck farm, and that's what we were just talking about, in November 2024, is likely a reassortment of circulating H5N1 with other avian influenza strains, such as those carrying the N9, a special gene, the N9 neuraminidase gene. So bear with me here. When one host is infected with two strains or variants at the same time, they can exchange genetic material to create a new variant or strain, a process called reassort. That's how this happens. And that's fairly common for flu viruses. The farm's outbreak began on 23 November 2024 and involved both H5N9 and H5N1 viruses. The epidemiological investigations are ongoing to determine the exact transmission pathway, the origin, and the potential risk factors. Sequence data from this virus is not yet available in public databases.
Well noted. Thank you very much, Christian. I think maybe it's a bit technical. If you could maybe share some of these notes for our benefit as well, we'll include in the summary. We have another question. Nick, is this for Christian?
Yes, it is for Christian. I'm just following up on what you've been talking about, which the avian flu. I mean, the understanding is that the Trump administration has halted all contact between all medical institutions and WHO. Is that correct? Because my understanding also is that you have been largely dependent on the American Animal Health Organization for your information on the spread of this H5N1 and H5N9 viruses. So where are you left if that communication is suspended? Thank you.
Yeah, I think an important question, Nick. Yet a bit early to talk about and to speculate, and I do not want to speculate how this plays out. It will play out. I mean, you heard announcements more than a week ago, then there was another announcement over the weekend, there was another announcement yesterday. So really, I would not want to speculate what this means tomorrow, if maybe tonight there's another announcement. But to say that data sharing all across the world has always been absolutely essential. And most of our, many of our biggest successes are based, I mean, humanity's health successes are based on data sharing, on the flu system, which shares the GISs, which shares data, the activities, the joint activities and polio programs, PEPFAR, a program initiated by the US. So many, many activities need the international collaboration, and it's a with you, for you approach, and we're all in this together.
Well said. Thank you very much, Christian. Any other questions for Christian before we do have another one for you, Robin, AFP.
Hi, Christian. Those countries and territories that are not in the WHO, do they still share data with the WHO? So would that make the United States a complete outlier if they don't have any contact with you at all?
I actually do not know how non-member states are or if they are sharing data, so that I would have to check.
Okay, thank you. Any last questions before we we have another one for you, Christian. Sorry, not up the hook yet.
Emma, sorry, Christian. Go ahead. I was just wondering, this is a theoretical question, but could a state of the United States of America decide to join the WHO? Is there any rule against that? I mean, from my knowledge, it's just countries, but would that be possible in theory? Do you know?
That expands my knowledge, but I would concur with what you just said. It's member states, and otherwise it would mainly be a question for the US if they would allow such a thing. But I would assume now, again, this is really speculation, that we're talking member states, not member area, member counties or member, I don't know what, cities even.
All right. Thank you very much. I think that's an interesting question. Thank you for that. Any further questions before we wrap with Christian? No? Okay. Well, colleagues, this may be my easiest chairing job. I just have one announcement in that case. before we wrap up this over an hour and a half briefing, just to announce, as usual, a couple of human rights meetings going on. We have the Committee on the Rights of the Child, as you know, started a couple of weeks back, and it's concluding its session this coming Friday, the 31st of January, with a meeting with states. Actually, this afternoon, Thursday afternoon, the 30th, there'll be a meeting with states, and then they'll conclude their session Friday, this coming Friday, the 31st. Also wanted to flag that the Conference on Disarmament, they will kick off their next plenary session this coming Thursday as well, 30th of January, in the Tempest Room, which is the, as you know, the construction by the flags. And this is under the presidency of Leonardo Bencini of Italy. And also the UPR session, the Universal Periodic Review, is still underway. It wraps up this coming Friday. And per the questions posed earlier, we will certainly keep you up to speed on the developments in New York on Security Council meeting on the DRC. We'll make sure to send you any statements that come our way. We'll keep an eye on this fluid situation. And on that note, thanks to all our briefers today. And I will see you here on Friday. So with that, if there are no questions for me, I wish you bon appétit until Friday.